You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. Researchers describe Trojan Source, a hard-to-detect threat to the software supply chain. A ransomware gang takes a page from the information operator's book. From double extortion to triple extortion, as other ransomware gangs add distributed denial of service to encryption and doxing. Criminals are now hacking on material, non-public information, the FBI warns. Joe Kerrigan looks at multi-factor adoption at Twitter. Our guest is Steve Reagan from Akamai on API security. And criminals hit healthcare providers in Newfoundland. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Tuesday, November 2nd, 2021. Researchers from the University of Cambridge have described a new attack method they're calling Trojan Source. The method abuses Unicode. The researchers explain, quote, rather than inserting logical bugs, adversaries can attack the encoding of source code files to inject vulnerabilities. These adversarial encodings produce no visual artifacts, end quote. Trojan Source places BD override characters into comments and strings from where they're moved into source code in ways that compilers accept and that will appear unproblematic to human reviewers. The method amounts to a software supply chain vulnerability. The researchers, both affiliated with Cambridge, write in their abstract, quote, we present a new type of attack in which source code is maliciously encoded so that it appears different to a compiler and to the human eye. This attack exploits subtleties in text encoding standards such as Unicode to produce source code whose tokens are logically encoded in a different order from the one in which they are displayed, leading to vulnerabilities that cannot be perceived directly by human code reviewers. Trojan Source attacks, as we call them, pose an immediate threat both to first-party software and of supply chain compromise across the industry. We present working examples of Trojan Source attacks in C, C++, C#, JavaScript, Java, Rust, Go, and Python. End quote. The ability Trojan Source has to affect software written in a broad range of languages is noteworthy. The researchers think compiler-level defenses will be important, and they also describe mitigations that can be used in editors, repositories, and build pipelines until compilers are effectively upgraded to deal with the risk. Krebs on Security summarizes a few experts' reactions. Some are surprised by how readily compilers will uncritically parse Unicode. The potentially malicious code also persists through copying and pasting, and that, of course, is a common developer's practice. Fixes to compilers will be required to foreclose the possibility of Trojan Source attacks. Among other things, the researchers' paper affords what Krebs calls a fascinating case study on the complexities of orchestrating vulnerability disclosure. When the researchers began notifying software firms whose products were affected, They offered a 99-day embargo on public disclosure to give the firms an opportunity to address the issue. They described the reception they received, quote, "We met a variety of responses ranging from patching commitments and bug bounties to quick dismissal and references to legal policies. Of the 19 software suppliers with whom we engaged, 7 used an outsourced platform for receiving vulnerability disclosures, 6 had dedicated web portals for vulnerability disclosures, 4 accepted disclosures via PGP encrypted email, and 2 accepted disclosures only via non-PGP email. They all confirmed receipt of our disclosure, and ultimately 9 of them committed to releasing a patch." End quote. So, the moral with respect to coordinated vulnerability disclosure is that it's complicated, as the kids say about their relationship status in social media. Ransomware gangs continue to evolve their tactics. The Daily Beast reports that the Grief Gang has sought to ratchet up the pressure on the National Rifle Association, recently one of the gang's victims, by amplifying the threat of leaks with an army of Twitter bots created in August and September. The bots have the usual hallmarks of inauthentic accounts. They appeared at about the same time. They neither follow anyone nor are they followed by anyone, and they're focused on retweeting news about compromised NRA accounts. And, naturally, a large fraction of their posting is written in what the Beast calls stilted English, which we take to mean a dialect of shadow brokerese, that commonplace criminal lingua franca. It's a familiar information operator's technique, and in this case it appears to be applied for criminal effect, although, of course, an unstated political motive might be present as well. Some of the troll bots are also tweeting about gun violence and the alt-right, which suggests a possible interest in general disruption. Still, it appears an effort to make the victim's seat even warmer. An FBI alert issued Friday warned that the Hello Kitty ransomware gang, also known as the Five Hands, had added a third threat, distributed denial-of-service attacks, to the now familiar double extortion threat of encryption, followed by the threat of doxing. The Bureau warns, quote, "The FBI first observed Hello Kitty Five Hands ransomware in January 2021. Hello Kitty Five Hands actors aggressively apply pressure to victims, typically using the double extortion technique. In some cases, if the victim does not respond quickly or does not pay the ransom, the threat actors will launch a distributed denial-of-service attack on the victim company's public-facing website. Hello Kitty Five Hands actors demand varying ransom payments in Bitcoin that appear tailored to each victim, commensurate with their assessed ability to pay it. If no ransom is paid, the threat actor will post victim data to the Babook site or sell it to a third-party data broker." End quote. So, distributed denial of service continues to enjoy its continuing mild comeback, and double extortion, encryption, plus data theft and the threat of exposure may be evolving in the direction of triple extortion, encryption, plus doxing, plus DDoS. The FBI also warned yesterday of a ransomware attack that's familiar but remains prominent. Gangs time their attacks to coincide with significant events. We're accustomed to seeing attacks timed to hit over holiday weekends, for example, when victims' guards are thought likely to be lower. But in this case, the noteworthy events are financial ones. Quote, "The FBI assesses ransomware actors are very likely using significant financial events, such as mergers and acquisitions, to target and leverage victim companies for ransomware infections. Prior to an attack, ransomware actors research publicly available information, such as a victim's stock valuation, as well as material non-public information. If victims do not pay a ransom quickly, ransomware actors will threaten to disclose this information publicly, causing potential investor backlash." End quote. The Bureau's description of the way these operations work is interesting, and it tells a story that makes sense with respect to the increased complexity of the criminal-to-criminal market. It begins with reconnaissance, probably conducted by an initial access broker who will select the right targets to offer the right criminals. The inspiration for the financial event approach seems to have been provided by a ransomware actor who, in 2020, encouraged participants in the Russophone hacking forum exploit to use information from the NASDAQ to lend vigor and urgency to their scams. Soon thereafter, quote, unidentified ransomware actors negotiating a payment with a victim during a March 2020 ransomware event stated, we have also noticed that you have stocks. If you will not engage us for negotiation, we will leak your data to the NASDAQ and we will see what's going to happen with your stocks, end quote. Among the gangs that have adopted the approach of extortion based on material non-public information was DarkSide. Others can be expected to follow suit. From the criminal's point of view, there's very little downside. And finally, lest anyone be inclined to take the high-minded assurances the gangs often tender in their communiques, the Robin Hood shtick they cop when they claim to respect the public good and avoid hitting targets whose disruption would actually hurt people, like, oh, say, hospitals or healthcare providers. There's this news from Canada. Reuters reports that an apparent ransomware attack detected Sunday has disrupted healthcare management services in the province of Newfoundland. The incident has forced cancellation of some appointments, and the Niagara Falls Review says that healthcare providers in the province have temporarily reverted to paper records. The effects seem more inconvenient than deadly, but still, it's worth bearing in mind the next time a gang talks about how they carefully distinguish legitimate from illegitimate targets. Buoy. These aren't targeteers interested in following the rules of war. Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. Security firm Akamai recently released the latest version of their State of the Internet report, with this round focusing on the security of APIs. Steve Reagan is a security researcher at Akamai, and he joins us with highlights from the report.
Over the last 10 to 15 years, we've gotten really good at strengthening application development, SDLCs, and things like this. But when you look at modern web applications and compare them to like API-focused applications, you see that the API stuff is sort of not regressing, but they're experiencing the same growing pains that web applications did years ago. It's like history repeating itself. And that became very clear when you looked at like the Spring Boot applications that we examined in the report. We're talking hard-coded credentials, SQL injection vulnerabilities, cross-site scripting, configuration problems, you know, just all the stuff we saw with web apps years ago. You're seeing it now in API development. And it's growing pains. Like, it's nothing that can't be fixed. And so we explored that. That was one of the big highlights for me personally as I was writing the report. The other thing that stood out was watching the criminals target APIs and the way they were going about it. So I highlighted one instance in the report, and it's Twilio is the name of the application. Really popular service for developers. Mm-hmm. Well, what the criminals are doing is they're scanning the web and looking for the configuration files. And in a lot of these files, you'll find the necessary API key and credentials. A criminal gets a hold of that. They take your access and use it for their gain, which is very, very bad if you consider that, you know, it's used for text messaging and email communications, things like that. So that was another standout for me.
And what are the take-homes here in terms of recommendations based on the information that you all have gathered?
So one of the big take-homes for me, and we highlighted this when it came in, is organizations need to not only know what their APIs are, like what they're using and how they're using them, they need to make sure that they can find all of them in their organization. So track them, find them down and, you know, figure out where they are and how they're being used. Because a lot of organizations have had incidents involving APIs and they weren't even aware the API existed. So that's a problem. And then you look at, you know, now that you know where they are, test them. Understand, you know, are there any vulnerabilities with the API connector itself? Are there any vulnerabilities within the application that's leveraging the API? Test that stuff. You know, there's plenty of tools in the market and education available for developers. Take advantage of it. And then, of course, when it comes to the overall picture, leverage your existing WAF infrastructure and identity management stuff alongside any of your API security offerings. And what I mean by that is tie it all together. You know, if you're using single sign-on or, you know, really locked down access management at your organization or for your customers, make sure you tie that into all of your mobile apps or your web-based apps leveraging APIs. Because what criminals will do is they look for those gaps and they look for those weaknesses and they start to, you know, focus on that for exploitation.
You know, you mentioned at the outset that this report was the result of a collaboration. And it strikes me that I'm seeing more and more of that in the security world, that people are reaching out to, you know, colleagues and sometimes even competitors to try to come up with better insights than they'd be able to get on their own.
Absolutely. And that's the way it should be. And it should have been like that from all along. So obviously, Akamai is a security company. We're never going to, you know, back away from that. But our overall reach and goal, and this is the same for a lot of companies in the space and a lot of security professionals, we just want to make the world safer. We want to make the world better, more secure. We want to see people learn. We want to educate. And if that means, you know, collaboration between competitors or collaboration between, you know, companies operating in the same space or in some cases different areas of the security industry, then that's what needs to happen. You know, we are not shy with making sure that, you know, we work with the best. And that was, you know, one of my boss's goals when we started developing the SOTI for this year was to try and get collaboration. We worked earlier this year, we worked with another company, WMC Global, to produce a financial services report that literally, you know, we used our phishing data and cred stuffing data, and we used their phishing data and cred stuffing data, and we created a really comprehensive report on it. It's something I think needs to happen more. I'm quite happy we're able to do these type of team-ups.
That's Steve Reagan from Akamai.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And joining me once again is Joe Kerrigan. He's from the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute and also my co-host over on the Hacking Humans podcast. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Dave.
Interesting blog post came from the folks over at Twitter. This is written by Nick Foes and Nupur Golap. Mm-hmm. They are both senior-level folks at Twitter. And this is right up our alley for the stuff we cover over on Hacking Humans. It's titled, How We Rolled Out Security Keys at Twitter. Really interesting insights behind the scenes of what they did here, Joe. Can you share some of the details with us?
Yeah, a couple things. Number one, they're letting users use security keys, multiple security keys now.
Right.
Which is good because when I tell people to adopt a security key like a Yubico or a YubiKey or a Google Titan or whatever it is, they all use the same algorithm. It's an open algorithm from or architecture, actually, from the FIDO network.
Yep.
Or FIDO Alliance, rather. And I tell people, buy two of these things in case you lose or damage one of them,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that way you'd be locked out of your Twitter account. And getting support from Twitter for this, I imagine, would be like screaming into the void. You'd never hear back. So use two. And they're letting you do that now at Twitter. But interesting about this blog post, they talk more about the rollout of these keys internally. Because last year, you remember the Twitter hack that happened last year.
Yeah.
The reason that was possible was because the attacker socially engineered one of their internal people to give up a multi-factor authentication code that was sent via SMS.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And even if you were using a different kind of code, like the time-based codes, you know, these numbers on the apps that we have, like
right.
Google Authenticator or Microsoft Authenticator or whatever, that's still susceptible to being asked for.
Right.
Somebody can call you and ask for it, and people could give it up. So we say SMS is the least secure, and if it's the only one you have, the only option you have, you should still use it.
Yeah.
Don't disregard it because it's not as secure as anything else.
Way better than nothing.
It's way better than nothing.
Right.
But it's a lot worse than using a security key.
Yeah.
Right? And Twitter has this great blog post about their process of rolling these things out internally so this doesn't happen. They
yeah.
selected YubiKey 5s, the NFC and the 5C NFC, which are both USB and near-field communication. So you can use them on your computer or you can use them on your phones.
Right.
If you have NFC on your phones, which most phones have.
Yeah.
So the majority of this blog post talks about how they did this, what their process was for doing this. First, they selected a model and they went with the Yubico,
right?
The YubiKeys. Then they actually had to go and buy these devices, and they had to buy 5,500 of them, right?
Right.
And
some sales agent at Yubico had a good day that
right.
day.
Actually, I'm sorry, they didn't have to buy. They had to buy them for 5,500 users, and they bought two of them for
okay.
each user, right?
Okay.
So they sold 11,000 of these things.
Wow.
And then Yubico helped them with shipping.
Yeah.
Then they added the security key to the internal support systems so that people could register their keys. And then they let people register their keys. And then eventually they flipped the switch so that you would no longer be able to use the old SMS means of authenticating.
Right. And I think it's also worth emphasizing here that they switched to these keys and only these keys for
right.
internal use. You could no longer use the legacy
right.
types of multi-factor.
If you're a Twitter employee now, you have to use a YubiKey.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Which is great, I think.
Yeah.
They will never have an attack that happened the same way it did last time again.
Mm-hmm.
That will never happen to them because mm-hmm. there is no way to call somebody and ask for a code out of this thing. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
The next attack is going to have to be different of some kind if it's going to be successful.
Yeah.
They did have some great lessons learned here. Anticipate global shipping challenges was one of the things.
Yeah.
So make sure that you have that in your plan. Leveraging built-in keys, which are, there are things on your phones, like usually your like Apple's Touch ID and Face ID
mm-hmm.
and Android's built-in security key that will actually let you do a workaround. I've actually disabled password authentication on my Microsoft account.
Hmm.
I use the Microsoft Authenticator app now on my phone to authenticate into my Microsoft account.
Hmm.
However, I think that is also susceptible to social engineering attacks as well.
Hmm.
Somebody could just call me up and say, "Hey, Joe, go ahead and push that button. I'm about to log in." And you know, I mean, it would obviously require a whole lot of subterfuge, but it still works. Another thing they say is track enrollment, right? The last thing you want to do is flip that switch and lock out maybe half of your employees.
Right.
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 So track enrollment, encourage enrollment, and anticipate support needs, of course. And this is interesting. I found this is the last thing they talk about under lessons learned, encourage wider use. They actually made it clear to the employees that these YubiKeys were theirs to keep.
Hmm.
So essentially, they're giving people two YubiKeys. And they're saying, use these and use them everywhere. And this is fine because once these people leave, Twitter can invalidate the keys and secure the login. There's not a security risk here as long as they properly maintain the login credentials, right?
Right.
Which is part of any exit process for employees
yeah.
that exists regardless. But it's great that they're just giving them to people and saying, use these everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to become accustomed to using it at your job. And once you're accustomed to using it at your job, you understand the workflow.
Mm-hmm.
You're yeah. off to the races.
Right. And if somebody has it in hand as they're signing up for new things, I think it's more likely for them to check and say, oh, can I use this hardware key instead of or instead of nothing at all or
right.
or whatever. So just have that convenience of putting those out into the world seems like a good thing.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, as you mentioned, a really interesting article and hats off to these folks at Twitter for sharing this with the rest of the world. I think there's some valuable lessons here. All right, Joe Kerrigan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Dave.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Trey Hester, Brandon Karp, Peru Prakash, Justin Sabe, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.